So our church, we've been going through the book of Hebrews and just trying to journey through and try to understand a little bit more what it's about. The book of Hebrews comes in the New Testament, and it's actually, if you don't know, actually, they're not sure who the author of the book of Hebrews is. But the content in it was so significant, so true. When they looked at the whole of all the works out there, they said, this is definitely something that is inconsistent with the rest of the Bible and belongs part of it. They have some guesses on who might have written, but probably what's interesting about it is the book of Hebrews is really trying to highlight both what it meant to be Jewish and the history of the Jewish people and how that relates to Jesus himself. So again, when you understand this, this is kind of at the birth of what Christianity would have been. And Christianity itself was this kind of exploration of what Judaism was kind of all leading up to, and this kind of birth of this kind of moment. And so in the book of Hebrews, you get a lot of Jewish history and the kind of Jewish tradition and Jewish culture, and it's being explained. Now, for most of us, I'm assuming we're not Jewish, or we don't live still by those Jewish traditions. So for us, trying to read is just trying to kind of understand from a very cultural sort of difference or sort of background. And so in this passage, what we're looking at and was hoping to look at was Hebrews chapters 5, 6, and 7. But of course, Hebrews chapter 5, 6, and 7 looks like this, which is quite a lot. So I broke it up into two parts. Last week, we looked at sections 2 and 3. And this week, we're kind of looking at, well, this last week, we looked at those two sections. And this week, we'll be looking at 1, 4, and 5. Now, this morning, I preached it in one way, in a very kind of different sort of method. And this evening, I'm preaching it almost in reverse, so slightly differently, okay? So, what? You guys are crazy. I know. I didn't really know how I'm going to pull this off, but I'm going to do it now. And so, as I kind of unfold this, hopefully you'll be able to understand a little bit about some of the traditions and the Jewish culture that came through, but probably more importantly is what this has to do with us. And we're actually going to start at the section 5 that we're kind of highlighting, chapter 7, verses 20 to 28. Now, I don't know about you, but have you guys ever been promised something? Like someone said, no, I completely promise to you that I will be there. You know, you can trust me. I will be there. I will not be late. I'll be there for you. And you get there and you're really depending on them and you're waiting for them and you're waiting and you're waiting and before you know it, they're not there. And you're like, I thought I could trust you. You gave me your promise. You said, oh, I'm sorry. I just forgot. Now, I'm not saying this happened to me ever. But I remember when I was 9 years old and I was in my primary school and my neighbor used to say, oh yeah, we'll take turns picking up the kids. And so my neighbor would say, okay, it's our turn to pick up our kids. Now, I will say, our neighbors were quite well off. They're the only people I knew that had a Rolls Royce and also a limousine. And so sometimes I would get picked up from school in a limousine. Like, how weird is that? And sometimes I get picked up in a Rolls Royce. And some days, even though they promised to pick us up, they would forget. And so me, my younger sister, my neighbor, and my neighbor's younger sister would be waiting there outside the school. Waiting. And at some point we'd say, all right, it's been 45 minutes. She would just walk home. Now, the walk home was not, it wasn't horrible, maybe about an hour. And like, I'm 9, I'm the oldest one there, the other one's 8, 7, 6, don't worry, this is before there were laws against this sort of stuff, all right, whatever. And this is America, where everyone had guns anyway, so it's like, cool. So I mean, if someone attacked us, I'd just pull out my, no, actually, it's not true, at least not in the area I grew up. So we would wait 45 minutes, and it was really great to be like, you know, they promised to remember to pick us up. You know, it should be a guarantee that they pick us up. And yet, they did. And so we'd walk home, and I'd be really angry, and then we'd ring the doorbell because we weren't allowed to have our own keys yet, and hopefully my parents were home, and hopefully their neighbors were home. And then someone would be mad at someone else and be like, oh, how come you forgot to pick them up? And they'll be like, oh, I thought it was your turn. And then that was it. But the next day, we get picked up in a Rolls Royce, and they all better. Now, I think for all of us, we have probably been let down by someone before. They made a promise to us, and then they turned their back on it. It might have been you were dating someone, and they said, oh, I'll love you forever, and then you guys break up, and you're like mad at them for the rest of your life. Or it could be, oh, you won £1 million. You're like, oh, I can't believe I won £1 million, and the tax man comes and says, oh, hey, you don't actually get $1 million. It says $1 million, but after taxes, you only get about $20,000. And you can either have that installment or one bulk payment. You're like, this is not true. I thought I was guaranteed this sort of thing. Let's say it's other things. Let's say you buy a your phone, you get your Apple Care on it, and you say, "Oh no, I dropped my phone, it broke." And they say, "Oh, sorry, we don't cover accidental damage, right?" But I thought there was a guarantee on this. I thought there was a warranty. I thought there was 100% chance that this would be taken care of. And time again, we find ourselves let down by the fact that no promises ever seem that true or that valid. And even as much as I would love to say it, like when you get married and you make that vow before God that somehow it is always going to work out perfectly and you're going to, after that wedding day, you'll live happily ever after. A lot of times you find that even those promises made sometimes don't get kept. And the hard part about that is we go through life then not trusting or not knowing where security can be found or whether these guarantees are actually really reliable. See, in the last part of Hebrews, in this first section in Hebrews chapter 7, kind of in the middle, there's this line that comes out that talks about Jesus. And it says, this makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. And what's saying out here is that this guy, Jesus, in what he does and who he is, and how he is the perfection of this system that was there before, he is this absolute guarantee. He is a 100% guarantee. He is not going to suddenly at the last second pull his like rug out from under your feet and say, "Ah, I was just kidding this whole time. You thought this whole time that you could trust me, but you can't." It's not like that. In fact, it's not just that he's a guarantee. What it says is he is the guarantor. Now, there's a difference between a guarantee and a guarantor. Guarantee is the legal document that says, we promise this to be true. The guarantor is the one that says, I promise it to be true, and if it does not come out to be true, I will take the responsibility upon myself. You want a guarantor because that person takes the liability on themselves. Now, the beautiful thing about this is it's saying, actually, Jesus makes himself the guarantor of something better. And a covenant itself is a promise. And what it's saying is Jesus is saying, actually, he makes this better promise to the ones in the past. And him himself, as a guarantor, guarantees that that will come to pass. Now, I don't know about you, but in my own life, sometimes I find it very hard to trust or to believe that these things will come true. I've been let down so many times in the past. I've been let down by myself so many times in the past. I don't know how many times I said, "No, I'm going to stay up tonight all night, and I'll work really hard, and I'll finish this essay." And the next thing you know, I'm asleep. I don't know how what happened. I thought I had such great motivation. I thought I could trust myself, but really, I couldn't. There's something about humanity that even if we have the best intentions, we often fall so short. The beautiful thing here is that we have Jesus, who is God himself, Almighty, but made himself so that he could be human, so that he could understand, he could be with us, he could understand the plight and the suffering of humanity, himself give himself as a guarantor for this promise. See, the passage goes on from there and says in verse 23, "The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing office. But he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save the uttermost, those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them." Now, this is starting to talk about this thing called a priesthood. For us, we might not understand exactly what a priesthood is. For a lot of us, maybe we're not involved in organized religion, or the only kind of organized religion we know about is the kind we read about on the news. And at this moment, if you're in the priesthood, it tends to be the news about you is bad. You've committed some sort of atrocious crime, and everyone's mad at you because this is the deal. We trusted these priests. Our picture of a priest is that person is holier than us. They are gooder than us. I will use the word gooder. I do not care. Because I'm not a priest. I can use bad English if I want. There's this ideal, right? And the idea is this. Look, I know as a human, I'm not that good. You know, I wish I was really good. And I know God, if God is perfect, if God is supposed to be the best ever, that somehow we all think to ourselves, you know what? If I was a good person, maybe at the end of my life, God will say, "You know what? Bert, he wasn't that bad. He didn't kill anybody intentionally. He didn't rob any banks. You know, he's not a bad person. I will accept him into heaven." I think that's the way a lot of us kind of think. But at the same time, we think to ourselves, well, I also know that my friend, he is even better than I am. Now, if God should only pick one of us, me or this other person, and this person was way better than I was, like he was actually nice to his parents, or he loved his wife, or he didn't tell as many lies, I guess maybe God would choose him. It's kind of like we feel like it's like a university, right? God's picking, he's looking at the UCAS forms, he's saying like this person scored a 65, this person got a 75, and then there's always that one other student who got like a 98, and you're like, ah, it took my place. And you think to yourself, oh, well, God's gonna have to take the better person. And if we look at our own lives, there's always gonna be someone who's better than us in terms of goodness or in terms of love or in terms of patience. I'm just being honest here because I know I am not the best kind of person out there. Now, for us, we're always thinking, well, look, if I believe that there was God and he's there and he's good and he's going to judge me by my life, and if he looks at my life in the scope of actually all of humanity, and there must be at least 50% of the world that's better than me, like, why would I be accepted into this place? Not just that, if God is perfect, how can he allow anyone that's not perfect to be in that same place? So we think, actually, and this is what Jesus, this is also God set out, that there should be a priesthood. A priesthood was kind of like this. Look, we know that we're not that good, but these priest people, they are supposed to be better. They have to try to act better. They have to live by a stricter code of rules so that their goodness might be added to your goodness so that somehow you might draw closer to God. But even in this premise or this kind of organization, this set out by God before, he was saying, look, this is still insufficient. It's still not good enough. Having a priest somehow take your place or to pay in terms of sacrifices for you to go there. It's saying out here, look, previously, all those priests, one of the big problems with the priests were they kept dying, not because they were bad, because they got old, and eventually they died. And so you had to replace them with another priest. But Jesus, after he died on that cross, and he rose to life again, he became this priest forever. You didn't have this priest who was almost good enough, who was still broken in many ways, who would pass away and then you have another priest come into office. Let's try to understand this again in another way. If there was a priesthood, and some years you had a really good one, and he was very holy and very moral and very good, but then he died, and the next year the guy who took his place was really bad. Maybe you know what the better example of this is? Probably your politicians. And because I'm from America, I would use our politicians, because it's very fun to think about them at the moment. Let's say one year you have a president who is well-spoken, well-mannered, polite, husband to one wife, harasser to no women, and he's a good president, and he does good things, and you think, yes, he leads our nation well, we can trust him, he'll be good. Yes, he's not of a white ethnicity, but that's okay, right? And then he finishes his term in office and he leaves. In the similar sense, he might pass away, his story's over. And then a new one comes into place. And this one, also technically, maybe, at each moment in time, only the husband of one wife, but one of many other wives before. Possibly a bit loose around women. Possibly, you know, may or may not tell lies every 30 seconds. You know, there's this kind of picture of him where he is less trustworthy as a leader. And yet he is still the one who is appointed in that position. He's still one that's in the place. And because of that, there is this almost this thing where, like, if we're here and the president or the ruler, or in this case the priest, is in charge, does that draw us any closer to God? In other words, this system itself is flawed. There can be no human priest that is going to be good enough for this story. Because humans themselves are corruptible. They're flawed. They're sinful. As good as I wish I was, my fear is if I did become president, I would make a lot of bad, selfish decisions. Because I would look at the situation from my own eyes, from my own cultural baggage. And I would bring those into my policies, the same as any priest would, same as any person would. But Jesus, in his perfection, in his eternity, comes and takes this role of this priest, where he says, I come in between you and God, and I look at all that you have gone through, and I understand it, and I make atonement for it. I pay for what you have done wrong. That's what the priests did. They would take the sacrifices, and the sacrifice represented atonement. In other words, what you have done wrong, this animal will pay in blood, and I will offer that sacrifice on your behalf. And also for the things that I've done wrong, I will offer these sacrifices as payment. Jesus, in his perfection, says, "Yep, I see all that you've done wrong, and I have given my own life as payment for that. And because of that, you can now be restored with God." It's where this thing where it says, "He is able to save the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them." There's this beautiful picture here of this eternal Jesus who is here in between us and God, mediating, but not just that, making intercession for us, interceding on our behalf, coming in the place to say, "Actually, I speak out on behalf of this person, and I defend them, and at the same time, I take the guilt and the punishment they deserve, so that they can be 100% guaranteed to be with you, God." He is the absolute guarantor that no matter how your life was, your life can now be in harmony with God. See, there is something really precious about being in harmony with God. You're suddenly at peace with who you are, who you have been made to be. You're not fighting for recognition anymore. You're not fighting for purpose or belonging. Because when you are at peace with God, when you're not at war with him anymore, you have this understanding that actually our God, who is in all-powerful, all-knowing, almighty, still welcomes you, still draws you in, and he is on your side. If that means your life is suddenly has this freedom, has this victory that was otherwise missing. See, this passage goes on where it says, "For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like the other high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins, and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever." Like I said, all the other high priests, they need to make a sacrifice as a payment for their own kind of situation. But Jesus, in his perfection, says, "Actually, I offer my own life as payment, so that we can be connected with God." You get this picture then of who Jesus is. He is holy. He is innocent. He is unstained. He is the perfect 100% did nothing wrong in his life. That if God looked down and said, "If there's one person here who is completely good, it is Jesus." No one can compare to his heart's goodness, his life's goodness, his mind's goodness. Everything about him was perfect in that way. He was permanent priesthood. He's not fluctuating. He's not going to die. He's not going to have to be replaced. He's not temporary. He's not this guaranteed contract that's good for 6 months before you have to sign a new contract. He is this eternal one. On top of that, he's an eternal intercessor. He is always there interceding for us on our behalf. In other words, he is there defending what we have done, taking what we've done wrong, taking it upon himself and saying, "This person is now guilt-free before God." On top of that, Jesus himself was then exalted above the heavens. He has this place and this position with God. He becomes essentially a king, and he is perfect forever. If I can illustrate what this looks like. So if this was God, and this is you, and the orange is like how good you have to be to get to God. And I think all other religions have this idea like, if you are good, then God will look on you with favor, and then you might be accepted into his kingdom, or you might have this eternity with him. And even if you aren't a believer in God, there's still the sense of you should still be as good as you can relative to yourself and other people in the hopes that somehow you will be a betterment to society, which is essentially their picture of how important it is to do that. But that goodness only goes so far. You can only be so good. Because even what we think is good can sometimes be tainted by our cultural background, our perspectives of what we've learned in society, or even the things that we think. A perfect example of this is food, and what we think is good food, or what is appropriate food. And the Bible uses this all the time in terms of food laws and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. In Chinese culture, it's like all food is acceptable. It's not just all food. All parts of an animal are acceptable food. Like, it's all, everything's fair game. I mean, yeah, sure, whatever. Intestines, spleen, bladder, liver. The weirder it is, probably the greater health benefits, we believe. No, we don't know any better. Or do we? And for us, there's this whole cultural sense of, my mom used to say this all the time to me, how come you're not eating that? That's the best part. Like, that is the most good part.
Fish eyeballs.
What? Yeah, the fish eyeballs, right? The fish cheek. I don't know, all sorts of weird things. I mean, think to yourself, what? Why? Why would you think that as good?
Why not?
And of course, when you go to a different culture and they hear about all the kind of things you eat, they're just like, oh, that's disgusting. Why don't you just have these boiled vegetables instead? Nothing is better than boiled vegetables. And then once it's out, cover it with gravy. Just loads and loads of gravy. Everything with gravy makes it better. Gravy. Well, like, and everyone, well, is that kind of good? And then you come to another culture, which is like, how can you guys eat any of that? We all have such strong opinions of what makes food good. But actually, if you wanted to break it down to it, what really is good food? Because the vegans and that we're talking about have a very good case that actually the only good food is the kind that doesn't destroy the environment, unless you have mass crops everywhere using pesticides, which was the other point brought up. In other words, this concept of good can be so influenced by our culture, by our upbringing, by our perspective, that we lose sight of what actually good is. And there have been many times in the past where we have thought we have done something good, only to find out that it was bad in the end. It's why there's something so important about having this absolute, this God who is not only this guarantor, but says, let me show you what is good. Let me show you what are the things that really matter, the things that are valuable. And he points us to things that really do matter in life, your character, the way you treat one another, the relationship and the bonds are formed there. Compassion, understanding, patience. But all these things are hard too, right? But those are the things that are good. And then when we look at our lives and we say, gosh, how good could I be? How good could I be to this thing? You start realizing that even you humanly have limits. There is still going to be this selfishness or self-protectiveness that kind of shows up there. See, back then there was this idea that you need this priest. And this priest maybe would teach you what the good things are, and this goodness would try to help you with your goodness. And like I was saying before, you would have to make this sacrifice to this priest. This priest would take the sacrifice as atonement for what you've done so that your life could get closer to God. And the priest himself would have to make this sacrifice. And all of this was pointing to the system that God was pointing out to say, look, this is what you think you need to do. This is what you think is important. And this kind of structure is what you think will bring you close to God. But at the end of the day, unless you have a perfect sacrifice that can pay for what you've done, that perfectly covers over all the wrong that you've done, unless you have a perfect priest who lives eternally to make that sacrifice, who understands your needs perfectly, then this system would always fail. It would always be insufficient. You would need the perfect one to do that. And that's who Jesus was. He came to not only be the perfect priest, to understand what that goodness was, so that he could teach you and also cover over the things you've done wrong. But he was also the perfect sacrifice, so that he could make offering or atonement for what we've done. See, the other thing that comes up in this passage is this guy called Melchizedek. Now, Melchizedek is this kind of, it's a weird name. It's very interesting. And this guy actually shows up in the Bible for just very, very briefly. He just shows up for two passages, primarily in the Old Testament. And outside that, he shows up in Hebrews in the New Testament. But he shows up in this passage called Genesis 14, 18 to 20. And what it is he is the king of Salem. And Salem is this place that was also known as a place of peace, Salem meaning peace. But he was also a priest of God Most High. Now, this guy Melchizedek is bizarre. Because up until this point in the story, God had only said he had appeared to, he called Abraham to be his chosen person, to begin this new nation, to be the father of many nations. And Abraham was following God, and God said, go and leave your home country, and I will make you into a nation. You'll be a blessing to many nations. And he goes out, and he actually has this battle, and he wins. And on the way back, he goes, and he meets this king of Salem, Melchizedek. Now, the interesting thing about this Melchizedek guy, called the king of Salem, was also a priest of God Most High. Now, this is where it gets weird. Like, how is this guy Melchizedek a priest? Like, who made him a priest? How does he know who God is? And yet, at the same time, how does he know this God is the same God as Abraham? But when they meet, Abraham knows immediately, oh, this Melchizedek guy, he knows the same God that I know. And what he does is Melchizedek gives him a blessing. He says, blessed be Abraham, my God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who has defeated your enemies for you. And then Abraham gave Melchizedek a tenth of all his goods he'd received. In other words, it's like an offering. It's like a tithe. He's saying, wow, thank you for the blessing. I give this offering to you as a sign of I'm not as superior. You are superior to me. Now, this Melchizedek guy exists within the story because it helps to create this archetype, this perfect picture of someone outside of Jewish culture who at the same time knew and loved God, whose priesthood was ordained and given by God. It made the Jewish people understand that there is something greater even outside their own culture that they don't understand fully, but actually within their history almost becomes legend. He shows up again in the book of Psalms where they write about him, and they say, just again, this guy, this priest who has no beginning, no end, Melchizedek. Now, the story about this then becomes, look, for the Jewish people, Abraham was the father. He is the patriarch. He was the founder and CEO of Jewish People Incorporated. Okay, right? He was the very originator of it. And they looked at him as, you know, the big one, the one they always remember, the always one they kind of look to. But when they hear the story and they know this story, where Abraham himself gives a tenth of his tithe, he gives a tenth of his life to his spoils of war to Melchizedek, there's this picture where Melchizedek is in some ways greater than Abraham. He is also this priest king. The cool part about this is in the book of Hebrews, he starts saying, look, God himself says, actually, I appoint you, Jesus, to be my son, in the same priestly order of that as Melchizedek. In other words, you're not just Jewish, but your priestly order is that from outside. You are this almost eternal God. You are from this kind of legendary archetype of Melchizedek, but Jesus, you are the real thing. Where Abraham had to give a tenth of the tithe to Melchizedek, it then made this picture that actually even this was insufficient to get to God. Like, even though Abraham is great, even though Melchizedek is greater, it was still not enough to be close enough to God. But it's only Jesus who then makes that way, who is in this kind of same priestly picture of Melchizedek, who is this eternal person, who is outside of just the Jewish culture, yet still 100% part of the Jewish history, who is this priest king, same as Melchizedek, who is this perfect offering, like we said before, who gives himself as this perfect sacrifice. And finally, who is eternal. When we have this picture of Jesus, you get this understanding, and this is what the author of Hebrews is really trying to lay out. Jesus is greater than Melchizedek, this legendary archetype. He is greater than the high priest. He is greater than the priesthood of all priests before, and he is even greater than Abraham. Now, for Jewish people, this is all about honor. This is all about who gets the most respect. And when it's laid out so logically in this, it becomes very obvious that actually Jesus, he is the one that deserves the most honor and the most respect above all. He is greater than anything else out there. Now, in our life, I'm guessing most of us don't have a Melchizedek in our life. If you do, their parents were really mean to name them that. Or we don't even have high priests really anymore, unless you talk about like some bizarre card game that you play. And the priesthood's kind of disappeared as well, right? And we don't have these Abrahams. But for a lot of us, we do have this idea of honor. And the people that we honor are higher than others. The people that we think deserve more glory or more adoration than others. And how we hold those people in higher value than Jesus himself. I read a lot of books. I read a lot of articles about all sorts of things. And then there are people that I really admire and look up to. Some of these people I know. Some of these people I'm good friends with. Mine. Some of them I do not know at all. A lot of the things and the ideas of how we run this church, I look at stuff from Silicon Valley. I look at Steve Jobs. Even though he's a horrible person, some of the principles that I hear from him, I think really interestingly of. I think they're really great. People I really don't honor, people like Jeff Bezos, right? Like I don't think that great of him, but there are some things I think that he does really well. And in my own head, without even knowing it, I am creating some sort of systems of honor. People that I put in higher view or higher respect of others. Now, on one hand, that's good, because it means you should learn and care about people. But then there are other times where that honor is misplaced. Now, I have this good friend of mine. Actually, I can't say he's a good friend. I wish he was a good friend. But this person, like, I hold too high value of. All right? He works for a VC. He's a venture. He's like a smart guy and a venture capitalist. His wife is also very smart. And he grew up going to church with me. And he was my sister's friend. He's one of the smartest people I know. There's a lot of gestures and hand actions that I learned as I was 2 years younger than him, but I used to watch him and just be amazed by how great this person was. And he works in Silicon Valley, and when I think about him, or I read articles about him, or I watch his videos with Bloomberg on the internet, or I listen to a podcast about him, I think to myself, oh, this guy's so awesome. Like, I can't even get close to him. I wish I could be half as smart or as cool as him. I wish I could be like his wife, who, like, written really great books. Actually, her books are only okay, but still, she'd written them at least. And I almost become obsessively honoring them. Now, I know it's actually not that bad, but my sister, who they're actually really good friends with, and who see them, who actually go to their house and look after their chickens, my sister always says to me, I don't think this guy is the same as the one that's in your head. You know, like, they're really different people. He's not that great. Like, I see him all the time. He's really not that amazing. I'm like, no, I think you're wrong. He's pretty amazing. And not just that, like, I get so nervous when I have to talk to him. I think one year he emailed me and said, oh, I think this year one of my resolutions, I like to keep in touch with you more. I was like, oh. Now, in my head, as I say this out loud, I know I sound crazy.
Yeah.
But what's funny is, even in my heart, there is still this place of honor that he has in my life. Now, I know for a fact that it's not the same as I'm worshiping him. I don't have a shrine to him in my house where I light candles every day and leave oranges in front of him. No, it's not that. But it's funny. The way I treat him or the way I think about him means I give him more honor than he deserves. And it also means that actually the way I give honor to God is less. Like, I do not think about God or interact with God in the same kind of passion or even interest or even kind of reverence that I should. And in our lives, there are these things that come up. It could be an object. It could be a thing. It could be a person. It could be a title. It could be a degree. It could be a PhD. It could be a certificate. It could be anything. But when you start letting that desire for that honor become something greater than it is, you put that thing in the place of the priest. And you think to yourself, if I get that, then I will have this kind of greater completion. But what God is saying is, look, if you don't see that Jesus is there, then your greatest goal is too small. Because what Jesus does is connects you to God directly. Like, Jesus is the only one that can connect you to God directly because of what he did. When you think about that, then you start realizing, oh, wait a second. I think Jesus is better than I think. You know, like, he is way better than I think. He's not just some historical guy or some healer or some teacher. He is something much more beautiful much more powerful. See, this picture of Jesus is the one that actually connects us to God. It is the only thing that is 100% guaranteed. When you believe in Jesus, when you turn to him, you are 100% guaranteed that you are now able to come face to face with God. Like, it's ridiculous. It doesn't matter how bad you were in your past. It doesn't matter how wrong thinking you were. It doesn't matter what you used to do. Because of Jesus, because he is constantly interceding, because he is eternal, because he's that perfect sacrifice, it means that you have 100% guarantee with him as the guarantor of being able to come face to face with God. Not only that, is 100% sufficient. Like, it is enough. You are not lacking. You don't have to keep trying to do something better to get something, to somehow make it worthwhile so that God will love you. Jesus makes that way for us. I think for myself, that was one of the hardest things to understand. That I didn't have to try to prove my worth to God still. Like, I didn't have to come to church to show God, look, I'm a faithful Christian, don't you love me more? What was hardest for me to understand was, Bert, just trust God. Open up your heart so that he can love you more. Like, I'm used to hiding myself away, kind of being quiet in the back corner, defensible space, because I'm small and I need to escape just in case there's a battle. You know, I'm a timid person. I don't know how I survive on stage. But when you start understanding, actually, I don't have to hide away before God. But actually, my life is to say, let me be open before you. Let me trust you. You understand that you can have this 100% sufficiency because of what Jesus has done. See, in Hebrews 6, this is what it says. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf. This amazing promise that what Jesus has done, this victory that we have, him as this perfect guarantor of the covenant, it is as sure and steadfast as an anchor of the soul. Now, you know what it's like for your hearts, right? Sometimes you feel lost. You feel like you've lost your purpose. You don't know where you belong. Emotionally, you feel like you're up and down, you're all over the place. You're trying to figure out what your meaning is or where your hope is. You're trying to find out where you fit in with your family or with your future, whether you're going to find the one or whether the one was already passed by. And when you're like that, it feels like you're just cast adrift in the sea, and any which way the wind blows, you're just going to be sucked in that direction. For if you're finishing a university, trying to make choices, you're figuring out what am I supposed to do? And what we have here is this promise where it says that actually this is as sure and steadfast as an anchor for your soul. Like, what an amazing promise is that? Instead of letting your soul be swept around, being lost, being confused by its own emotional state, or its heart, or your mind being lost, you have it completely anchored in this promise that actually Jesus is our perfect hope. He is our light, he is our salvation, he is our victory. There is nothing that can take that away from us. There is no storm so big that can disrupt that anchor. There is no crisis so large. There is no Brexit so confused that can somehow sway this anchor of Christ. That only happens because Jesus is not like us. I would make a horrible anchor. It's, you know, I would turn at the smallest thing, but Jesus himself, because he is perfect and he is eternal and he is this guarantor, it gives us this absolute assurance. See, we have this beautiful promise coming here that says Jesus, he is our anchor, he is our guarantor, he is our intercessor, he is our high priest. Now, the way that unfolds is this. If Jesus is your anchor, if your life feels out of control or lost, you just have to say, actually, Jesus, you are my anchor. Let me trust you with my life. Let me trust you that actually, Jesus, it will be okay, right? You are there. I am anchor to you. I am not cast adrift. If Jesus is your guarantor, you can put your future in him. You can know that actually, as long as I keep walking in this life, I might keep following you. I know my future is secure. Actually, even if I get lost along the way, my future is still secure. Because I am dwelling with you in heaven. If Jesus is your intercessor, now is the time to come before him and ask for forgiveness. And actually, Jesus, this is what's gone wrong in my life. These are the decisions that I've made, and this is important. Because unless we come to him and say, actually, Jesus, this is what's going wrong in my life, this is where I'm lost, Jesus wants to anger you. But if you're not open and honest with him, he can't help deal with that stuff. And finally, if Jesus is your high priest, enter the holy place and be accepted by God. There's this beautiful picture that I have. Is actually what Jesus does for us is that he opens the way for us to be able to stand face to face with God in his perfection, in his glory. And not just that, you have the opportunity to speak to him face to face and look him in the eye. Like, I mean, I had a hard time looking my dad in the eyes growing up. I probably still have a hard time looking at my dad in the eyes because you're always scared that you've done something wrong or that they're going to get mad or that you're ashamed of something. Like, I know my kids, when they know they've done something wrong, when I try to look in the eye, there's a lot of, like, looking all sorts of directions. And actually, it took me a long time to get the courage to actually say, God, I'm scared, but will you, can I look into your eyes and know that you love me? And know that you forgive me and you draw me into your arms. And you don't reject me. So many of us have experienced rejection or disappointment or failure or angry words or guilt or shame. But Jesus, that perfect sacrifice, wipes that away so that we actually have this invitation to come before God and be accepted by him. As we come to worship and as we respond, I just really invite you to take this time to, especially if there's one of these words that really resonate with you, anchor, guarantor, intercessor, or high priest. If that's where it is, as you worship and as you sing out, just pray, say, God, actually, you know, you're my anchor. I want to trust you with my life. You're my guarantor. I want my future in you. You're my intercessor. I want to come and ask forgiveness. You're my high priest. Let me stand face to face with God. And just respond to him in worship through this. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, again, we are so amazed by your sacrifice that you are this perfect example, archetype. You are eternal. You are dependable. You are faithful. You have sacrificed yourself wholly and completely so that we can have this life eternal. And God, I pray right now as we come and we worship and respond, Lord. For some of us here, we feel like we are lost, a little bit cast adrift in the sea. We might feel like there are storms coming over in the middle of a storm at the moment. Lord, will you be our anchor, a sure and steadfast guarantee? For those of us who feel as if we don't know what's happening with our future, that sometimes we doubt even whether you accept us into heaven, that we remember that you are a guarantor. That you take the liability upon yourself so that we can be with you. And for those of us who feel ashamed of things, that we feel guilty, and we know that there are things in our life that are out of sync, that are not right, Lord, we come to you now and we just ask for forgiveness. We ask for healing to be on us. And finally, for those of us who struggle to come before you, God Almighty, to know the arms of love of our Father, will you meet us? And let's stand face to face with you, Almighty God. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's come and worship.